If you turn to the book of Hebrews, where we have reached in our study, the 13th chapter, verses 9 through 16, that will set forth this contrast between Judaism on the one side and Christianity. So this is chapter 13, and I want to begin our reading with the 9th verse. Chapter 13, verse 9. And he places this, as you recall, in prohibition. And he tells them to stop doing this. Stop being carried about by various and strange teachings. They're various and they're strange because they go against the gospel of grace. And then he writes in verse 9, "For it's good that the heart be established and made firm by grace, not by foods, in which things the ones who are walking or those who are being occupied have not benefited, have not been helped. It has not been advantageous or beneficial to them." And then he moves right into verses 10 and 11. Now, this is the 10th verse, Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 10. "We're having an altar out of which the ones who are serving in the tabernacle are having no authority or right to eat, for of which the blood of animals concerning a sin offering were being brought into the holies through the high priest, the bodies of these being consumed outside the camp." Now remember, when you come to verses 10 and 11, specifically verse 10, there are those who will say that this altar refers to the communion table, whereas others will say that this altar of verse 10 refers to the cross, or it refers to the place where the sacrifice of Jesus Christ took place. And if that were the case, then he's offering a contrast in verse 10 and 11 between Jews on the one side and Christians on the other. However, as we talked about last week, verse 11 seems to explain how one should interpret verse 10, seen in that little four that introduces verse 11. So I cannot read verse 10 without reading the writer's explanation in verse 11, four. And then he says, "of which the blood of animals concerning a sin offering are being brought into the most holy place, the Holy of Holies, through the high priest, the bodies of these animals being consumed outside the camp." So it seems to me, as we talked about last week, he's talking about this Old Testament ritual. He's talking about this tradition and this practice of Jews, specifically as it pertained to the sin offering and what the high priest would do concerning the sin offering on the Day of Atonement, where, as you recall, as you read it in Leviticus chapter 16, he would take the blood of the bullock and the blood of the goat. He would take that blood and go into the most holy place and sprinkle it upon the mercy seat, and then take the carcass of the bullock as well as the goat and take it outside the camp, and it was burned. So he could not partake, he could not eat of that sin offering that was offered, the bullock and the goat, in terms of the Day of Atonement. So it seems as though that's what he's talking about in verses 10 and 11. What the high priest would do in the most holy place in terms of the blood of the sin offering, and then what he would do in terms of the bullock and the goat, taking it outside the camp and burning it outside the camp. All of that dramatically pointing to Jesus Christ, who is the sin offering, and what Jesus Christ accomplished when he died. And as you recall, we talked about last week the importance of understanding the type, which would be the sin offering of the Old Testament, and the antitype, which would be the fulfillment found in Jesus Christ. So there is this type, antitype kind of relationship here when we read of verses 10 and 11. But the type, of course, would be the sin offering of Leviticus chapters 4 and 5. And the antitype would be the death of Jesus Christ and what he accomplished. So when I read these verses, 10 and 11, that's what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about the ritual of the high priest on the Day of Atonement concerning what he did with reference to the blood and the bodies of that bullock and goat that were offered as sin offerings. So I'm reading verse 10 and verse 11, and just think of that as we read it. Verse 10, we're having an altar of which the ones who are serving in the tabernacle are not having the right to eat. For, he explains, of which the blood of animals concerning the sin offering are being brought into the most holy place through the high priest, the bodies of these being consumed outside the camp, which of course is now anticipating the reality, not only in terms of the death of Jesus Christ, but the reality as it pertains to them. So look at verse 12. Wherefore, on account of which reason, also Jesus, emphasizing his humanity and his sufferings, in order that he might set apart through his own blood the people, suffered outside the gate. So now we're talking about the reality. So we have the ritual in verses 10 and 11. Now he moves to the reality and what Jesus did when he suffered outside the gate. And then we come to verse 13. And when you move into verse 13, he begins with the particle that introduces an inference. And you can translate it something like hence or indeed or so, something like that. So I come to the 13th verse, and here's the inference. Hence or so, let us go out to him. Now notice it. Outside the camp. And then he says, bearing his reproach. Now remember, on the basis of the exhortation, as you read it in verse 13, the camp would be what? Judaism. So you read the statement here. Now he's drawing the inference. Hence, let's go out to him outside the camp. Judaism, bearing his reproach, his disgrace, his insults that they were going to experience by fellow Jews or by the Jewish community who utterly despised Jesus of Nazareth. Now, if you remember last week, I read various statements from the Talmud, the Jewish Talmud, that every Orthodox Jew knows, and the various things that it said or says about Jesus. He was a magician. He was a sorcerer. He enticed Israel and led Israel astray. He was an apostate who now, according to the Talmud, is suffering torment in hell. Now, that's what the Talmud says. So an Orthodox Jew will not talk about Yeshua, which, of course, is Jesus. He only talks about Yeshu. And Yeshu means, may his name be blotted out. So when you think about these Jewish readers who have identified themselves with Yeshua, you can understand something of the hostility and the animosity they would have experienced on the basis of the Jewish community. And the writer is saying, leave Judaism, identify yourself with Yeshua, bearing his reproach. Now that is what we're reading here. Now let me read a statement about Baruch Spinoza. And I read a various article about him this past week that caused me to think about this particular text. Now, if you think about Spinoza, in 1656, he's 23 years old. He was excommunicated, cast out of Amsterdam's Jewish community in a public ceremony. And the text of the ban was read aloud at a synagogue in Amsterdam. And that ban has been preserved, and it makes clear that what the community objected to was not any personal misdeed by Spinoza, but his evil opinions, his abominable heresies, which he refused to recant under pressure. For this reason, the leaders of the synagogue declared Spinoza should be excommunicated, expelled from the people of Israel. They invoked the fearsome punishment for disobedience laid down by Moses in the book of Deuteronomy. Cursed be he by day, cursed be he by night, cursed be he when he lies down, cursed be he when he rises up, cursed be he when he goes out, and cursed be he when he comes in. And then we read this about Spinoza. The Jewish community into which he was born in 1632 was uniquely close-knit, set off not only from the Dutch Christians around it, but from other Jewish communities in Western Europe. Under the terms of the curse, all Jews, including Spinoza's relatives, were forbidden to talk to, even go near him. He could no longer hope to live among the people he had known all of his life, to do business with them, to get married, or to start a family. He was absolutely excommunicated for apostasy. Now, what he had done was, he basically denied that God exists as a being or intelligence separate from the rest of the universe. He was a pantheist. So because of his apostasy to pantheism, he was excommunicated and there was to be no dealings with him whatsoever. He died in 1677 at the age of 44. So I think about this man, and I think about how he was excommunicated by the Jewish community, and that he was dead to them. But when you think of what was taking place here, in terms of these Jewish believers who identified themselves with Yeshua, and you think of the incredible hostility of Jews against him, against Jesus, you can understand all the difficulties that they would have encountered and the sacrifices they would have had to make in identifying themselves with Jesus, because it meant the loss of everything that they had ever known. So we're reading it here, and we have to understand what the writer is saying and the sacrifice that these believers would have experienced. You want to think about hostility? Think of Stephen in Acts chapter 7 when he set forth that Old Testament survey and talked about Jesus. They dragged him out of the city and stoned him to death. And it's not just what happened to Stephen. He's the first martyr that we read about. The brother of Jesus, James, he was killed in a dreadful way as recorded by Josephus in the city of Jerusalem because of his identification with Yeshua, with his half-brother Jesus. So you read about the death, the martyrdom of Stephen, and you certainly read about the death of James, the half-brother of Jesus, as described by Josephus, by Jews. So when I read this here, I understand the writer is saying you have to move away from the ritualism of Judaism and you have to embrace the reality that is found in Jesus. Even though it's going to be costly and they're going to have to sacrifice an awful lot. So I'm reading this in verses 10 and 11 and I'm on the Day of Atonement and I'm thinking about the sin offering and the high priest could not partake of the sin offering. It was consumed, burned. And then he comes to the reality. Look at it again. We're in Hebrews 13, verse 12. Wherefore also Jesus, in order that he might set apart through his own blood the people, suffered outside the gate. Hence, let us go out to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. Now you come to the next verse, verse 14, and he's going to further explain something. And I want you to notice his explanation. For here, we're having no abiding city, but we're earnestly, diligently seeking one about to come. Now that is an amazing statement from the writer. Now think about the fact that these Jews were going to be rejected, these Jewish Christians. They were going to be rejected by their family, by their friends. Certainly they're turning away from their religious traditions. They are turning away. I mean, just think about it. The temple is still there. The center of worship is still there in Jerusalem when he says this to them. So they're to turn their back in terms of the temple. The entire Old Testament system that's been superseded by what Jesus Christ has done. They're to leave all of this behind and they're to wholeheartedly identify themselves with Jesus. But think about what they're leaving behind. They're leaving behind all that they've ever known. Physical worship center, the visible priest, the animal sacrifices, the ancestral traditions. They're leaving all of that behind because they realize there's nothing permanent here. Everything here is temporary. They're waiting, anticipating that which is permanent. Now I want to go back and I want to read a few statements because this is the way we have to think. Now I want you to go back with me to the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 23. And in Genesis 23, we read of Sarah's death. Sarah died. She was 127 years old. And Abraham's 137. And he has to have a place to bury his wife. And he says to this Kittite in verse 4, I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Now that's what we are. We're strangers, we're sojourners. He had to buy a place in order to bury his wife, but that's the only place that he possessed. But I'm reading that there. In verse 4, I'm a stranger sojourner with you. Now come to the end of the book, chapter 47, towards the end. And I want you to notice Jacob's words as he says this to Pharaoh when he's brought down into Egypt. And I want you to notice what we read in Genesis 47 and verse 9. And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, in the days of their pilgrimage. Now, he mentions his pilgrimage twice, and he talks about the days of the years. He's 130 here. Abraham died at 175, Isaac died at 180, and Jacob will die at 147. He lived in Egypt for 17 years. But I'm reading his words here as he's talking about his pilgrimage. And he talks about the days of the years of my pilgrimage. And he describes them, when you read it in verse 9, few and evil had the days of the years of my pilgrimage. And then you read that. I mean, just think about what he said. So Abraham certainly speaks of being a soldier and a stranger. And then Jacob, his grandson, is speaking of his pilgrimage. And not only his pilgrimage, but the pilgrimage of his grandfather and father. Now come with me to the book of 1 Chronicles, chapter 29. 1 Chronicles 29. And notice the statement from David. 1 Chronicles 29. And notice the 15th verse and what David is saying to the Lord. For we are strangers before thee and sojourners, as were all our fathers. Our days on the earth are like a shadow, and there is no expectation. Now here's David, and he's speaking of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he's also referring to himself. We are strangers, we're sojourners, as were all our fathers. And then he speaks of days. Our days on the earth are like a shadow, and there's no expectation. Now turn to a psalm that he pens. This is Psalm 39. And I want you to notice the words of David here in Psalm 39. He speaks of how brief our life really is here on this earth in verses 4, 5, and 6. And then we come down and we read the end of verse 12. For I am a stranger with thee and a sojourner as all my fathers were. A stranger, a sojourner as all my fathers were. And he talks about how brief this life is in verses 4, 5, and 6. I was talking to an individual just before Bible study, and he was going to a visitation of an individual who was on Saturday just climbing up this little ladder and had a massive heart attack and died, 65 years old. He's climbing up this ladder, he falls down, and he's gone, 65 years old. And this individual was going to this visitation that is taking place right now as his wife is left behind, who's about 65. No advance warning at all. Just a massive heart attack, gone. I mean, that's how quick our life is. And that's what he says here in Psalm 39. Now, David was 70 years old when he died. He was 70 when he died. But I'm reading the statement here in Psalm 39. And he's talking about being a stranger and a sojourner. But in verses 4, 5, and 6, he talks about how brief our life is. So we think about here, there's nothing permanent here. Everything is temporary. Now come back to the book of Hebrews and notice what he's going to say in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. And notice the statement as he goes back to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And notice his statements in verses 9 and 10. Verse 9, by faith he, that's Abraham, sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise, for he looked for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Now look at the same chapter and come down to verse 16. Let me read in verse 13. These are the patriarchs. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare clearly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from which they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. Now remember, they left Mesopotamia and went into the land of Canaan. They could have left Canaan and gone back to Mesopotamia, but they didn't do that. So we read, verse 16, but now they desire a better country, that is a heavenly country, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. Now come with me to chapter 12. Do you remember what he says in chapter 12, verse 22? You are coming to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn which are written in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made complete, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant. So now we're reading about this permanent city, and we're reading about the various ones that are in this city, in this other realm. And all of those who have left us, who are believers, they're in this realm now. This is where they are. So we just think about our loved ones. And we have spouses here that are gone. And we have children here that are gone. And we have parents here that are gone and grandparents. They're in another realm. But I'm reading this here. And I'm reading about the various ones in this realm. And all believing church-age saints are here. They're right here in this permanent place. They're in heaven. Now look at what he says in chapter 12 and look at verse 28. Everything here is going to be shaken and changed, but verse 28, wherefore we receive a kingdom which cannot be moved. There is going to be something that's permanent. And that is what the writer is talking about all through this book. Now, do you remember what he says about Jesus? In Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14, he says, Jesus passed through the heavens. You remember that? He passed through the heavens. How many heavens are there? Three. So he passed through the first and the second, and now he's in the third heaven, where his Father is. And where all of those individuals that we read about in chapter 12, that's where they are. They're in the third heaven. So I read chapter 6 and verse 20. And the writer says, Jesus is the forerunner who has gone before us, and he's paved the way. So Jesus has passed through the heavens as the forerunner, and he's there. And we're going to follow his lead as believers, because we're going to end up there. So I think about what he's saying in terms of that. I read it in chapter 4, 14, and I read it in chapter 6, verse 20. Now come with me to chapter 7 and look at verse 26. For such a high priest became us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled. Then I'm going to make a separation, and I'm going to say, separate from sinners. What made him separate from sinners? He's made higher than the heavens. That's what separated him from sinners. He's no longer here. He's made higher than the heavens. He's gone through the first and second heaven, and now he's in the third heaven. So he's gone through the heavens. He's the forerunner. He's now separated from all sinners down here. And now he's in heaven. He's in the third heaven. Now look at chapter 8. Look at verse 1. Now the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary of the true, genuine tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, not man. He's in the genuine tabernacle. The genuine tabernacle. So I'm reading it there in chapter 8, verse 2. Come to chapter 9, verse 11. But Christ being come a high priest of good things to come by greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood, he entered in once into the holy place. That's where he is. That's where he is now. So we come to chapter 9 and we read verse 24. For Christ has not entered into the holy places made with hands, which are the types of the real ones, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. That's where he is. So I think about our Lord, and I think about all of those who are believers who have passed from this realm, and that's where they are. They're in heaven. They're in this permanent place. Now, if there's one thing that is emphasized all through the book of Hebrews, it is this not yet. Not yet. And then he describes all of these future events that are going to happen. There's going to be a resurrection of the dead. There's going to be a future judgment. There's going to be an inhabited world to come. There's going to be a Sabbath rest. There's the end of this present age, and there is a future age to come. There is the second coming of Christ. There's a shaking of all of the things that are here. I mean, there's all of these not yet that are going to happen. And all through Hebrews, you read it. And I want to emphasize once again that little word better. Because you read the word better 13 times in Hebrews. 13 times. And we're talking about something that is better, something that is more advantageous. 13 times we read the word better. We have a better hope. We have a better covenant with better promises. We have a better sanctuary, a better sacrifice. I mean, all of these better, a better resurrection. All of these betters that we read through the book of Hebrews. So when I think about what the writer is saying, during this life there may be a sacrifice and it may be costly. But there's nothing in this realm that is permanent. We're intentionally yearning for something that's going to abide. And it's not here. It is this future place, being with this person that we know as Jesus. So when I come here to this 14th verse of chapter 13. For here, we're having no abiding city. But we are earnestly seeking the one about to come. And that ought to encourage these readers to endure, to persevere. Even if it's costly and you lose your family and all of this, it's still worth it. That's what the writer is saying. Now, if he talks about the ritual, which he does, in verses 10 and 11, and he talks about the reality that he does in verses 12 through 14, he shifts to the requirement. And the requirements in verses 15 and 16. And it's all based upon Jesus. Now look at verse 15. Therefore, you see this little phrase, through him. That is emphatic. I mean, you ought to underline it. It's placed first in the sentence. There's no question he is emphasizing that little phrase. For through him, and then he's got this extra, let us. And if you look at this verb, it'll say something like this. To put upon an altar, to bring to an altar, to offer up something. So we're reading it here. Therefore, through him, through Christ, let us offer up a sacrifice. And then you move into this. Now, the one thing that the writer wants us to understand is Jesus is our great high priest. And because of our union with him, we have become priests. All of us are priests. Now, I want to read a statement in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5. And I want you to listen to the statement in 1 Peter 2, 5. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up, same verb that's used in our text in Hebrews 13, to offer up as priest spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God. And then he says, through Jesus Christ. Through Jesus Christ. That's the only reason why they're acceptable to him. Through Jesus Christ. Now here he talks about a holy priesthood. He says, we're able to offer up spiritual sacrifices. We can do it to God in an acceptable way only through Jesus Christ. So I read it in chapter 2, verse 5 of 1 Peter. A holy priesthood. Now listen to chapter 2 of 1 Peter, verse 9. But you are, among various things, a royal priesthood. So what? Not only are we a holy priesthood, we are a royal priesthood. We are priest kings. We're going to reign with him. And we can offer up spiritual sacrifices that are acceptable to God only because of Jesus Christ. Now what I read here in 1 Peter 2, verse 5, verse 9, holy priesthood, royal priesthood, the Apostle John talks about in the book of Revelation. Now let me read the statement in Revelation chapter 1 and listen to his statement in verse 6. He has made us a kingdom, priest to God and to his Father. He's made us a kingdom, and then he says, priest to God and to his Father. Now that's Revelation 1 verse 6. Now listen to Revelation chapter 5. And the statement that is made in verse 10. You made us to our God a kingdom and priest. And we will reign as kings upon the earth. But there he talks about a kingdom and priest. Revelation chapter 5 verse 10. So when I read this in 1 Peter chapter 2. And I read this in Revelation chapter 1 and Revelation chapter 5. I recognize that we are priests. All of us are priests. The Old Testament, in terms of Israel, Israel had a priesthood. But you had to be from the tribe of Levi and you had to be from the family of Aaron. Otherwise, you would not be qualified to be a priest. So Israel had a priesthood. But when you move into the New Testament, all of us are priests. All of us are priests, which the reformers, you remember, argued in the 16th century, recapturing the thought of the priesthood of all believers. And we can offer spiritual sacrifices to God. Not physical animal sacrifices, but spiritual sacrifices. And they're acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Now I want you to turn with me to Romans chapter 12. And I want you to notice the statement in Romans chapter 12, because this is where it begins. Romans chapter 12, and notice verse 1. Therefore, I'm exhorting you, brothers, through the mercies of God, which of course will be chapters 1 through 11, to present, and I want you to look at that little verb, to present your bodies a sacrifice, living, holy, acceptable to God. And then he simply says, which is your logical worship. Now here he's saying that we are to present our bodies as a sacrifice. And then he describes it as living, holy, acceptable to God. And he says, it's your only rational, logical, we get our English word logical from this, logikos. It's your only logical, rational service or worship that you can give to God. Now, he mentions body here. Present your bodies. But he doesn't really explain it. But the verb that is used here, present your bodies, that verb is used in chapter 6. And I want you to turn back to chapter 6, and he's going to explain what he means. Now, this is in chapter 6, and I want you to notice verse 12. And the verb that we read in chapter 12, verse 1, is used here, and it's going to be used in verse 13, in verse 16, and in verse 19. But notice the way it's used. Verse 12. Therefore, let not sin reign as king in your mortal body in order to obey the desires of it. Neither keep on presenting your members of the body, as tools of unrighteousness to sin. But, here's the verb, present, notice, Yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, and your members, the members of the body, as tools of righteousness to God. So I want you to present yourselves, not your everything about you, and the members of your body, not as tools to do something that's wrong, but as tools to do something that's right. You're talking about the members of the body and what's going on within us. Now come down. Same word. You have it in verse 13 twice, but look at it the way it's used in verse 9, in verse 16. Do you not know that to what you are presenting yourselves slaves to obey? Slaves you are to what you are obeying? Either of sin to death or obedience unto righteousness. And do you see the word that is used there? Do you not know that to what you are presenting? Same verb. Now come down to the 19th verse. I'm speaking as a man on account of the weakness of your flesh. For just as, here it is, you presented your members slaves to uncleanness and to lawlessness and to lawlessness. So now, here's your verb, present your members slaves to righteousness unto holiness. So when you read it here, the same word that is used in chapter 12, verse 1, is used in this chapter. Twice in verse 13, you have it in verse 16, and you have it in verse 19. And that explains to me what it means to present my body. Is to present myself, everything about myself, and the members of my body unto the Lord in order to do that which is right rather than that which is wrong. So chapter 6 explains chapter 12, verse 1. So it begins there. I have to offer myself to God. And I'll have to offer all the members of my body, my mind, my emotions, my will, everything about me. And then I come here to Hebrews. I turn back to Hebrews. And then he's going to talk about some of these spiritual sacrifices. Now look at the words that he uses. Here are sacrifices. Not physical, not animal. We have sacrifices that we can offer, but they're spiritual sacrifices. Now here they are. Verse 15. For through him, let us offer a sacrifice, look, of praise continually to God, that is the fruit of lips acknowledging His name. Now what He's going to do is, He's going to cloak His language in terms of language found in the Old Testament. So there are various verses that we can think about. But the one verse that I want us to think about in particular is Hosea chapter 14. Now hold your place here. Turn with me to the book of Hosea, the first of the minor prophets, Hosea chapter 14. And He has taken that second verse. And He's quoting from verse 2. Now look at Hosea 14. And He's commanding Israel to do this. But look at verse 2. Take with you words. Turn to the Lord. Say to Him, take away all iniquity. Receive us graciously. Now look at this phrase. So will we render the calves of our lips. So will we render the calves of our lips. Now that is what He is citing in Hebrews chapter 13. But He doesn't quote the Hebrew Bible. He quotes the Greek Bible. And instead of calves, it mentions the word fruit. So we'll render the fruit of our lips. Because remember, the writer of Hebrews only cites from the Greek Old Testament. He doesn't quote from the Hebrew text. So he's quoting this particular text from the Septuagint. And where you have calves in the Hebrew, you have fruit in terms of the Greek. But if you talk about calves, we're talking about a spiritual sacrifice. So when I read it here in Hebrews chapter 13, there are other verses that you think about that the writer would be thinking about. A thanksgiving offering. Leviticus 7 verse 12. The psalmist, and what the psalmist says in Psalm 54 verse 6. What Isaiah says in Isaiah 57 verse 19. So you think about these various verses that talk about thanksgiving and praise. Leviticus 7 12, Psalm 54 verse 6, Isaiah 57 verse 19. He is citing from the Greek Bible of Hosea 14, 2. And we're simply reading this in verse 15. Therefore, through Him, chapter 13, verse 15 of Hebrews, let us offer a sacrifice of praise always, constantly, continually to God. That is the fruit of lips. Now look, acknowledging His name. Saying the same thing about His name. And then we read this, and then he uses this word, doing good, beneficence, and doing good and sharing, stop forgetting. For with these sacrifices, God is well pleased. So when you read of these spiritual sacrifices, there are three. Praise to God, that ought to be constant. Doing good ought to be constant. And sharing with others, which ought to be constant. Those are spiritual sacrifices we can offer to God through Jesus Christ, and they're acceptable. And we can offer them as believing priests. Praise, doing good, and sharing with others. So when I read verses 10 and 11, I'm thinking ritual. When I read verses 12 through 14, I'm thinking reality. And when I read verses 15 and 16, I'm thinking about requirement. Now, since we become priests and can offer spiritual sacrifices, here are three we can offer to God, and God accepts them. But all of this is grounded upon the death of Jesus Christ. And the death of Jesus Christ in the New Testament is mentioned at least 175 times. 175 times. at least in the New Testament, we read of his death and what his death means. Now I want you to turn back with me to Deuteronomy chapter 21, and I want you to notice the statement in Deuteronomy 21. Deuteronomy 21. And look at verse 22 and 23. Verse 22, Deuteronomy 21. And if a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he be put to death, and thou shalt hang him on a tree, his body will not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day. For he that is hanged is cursed by God, that thy land be not defiled, which the Lord thy God gives thee for an inheritance. Now, anyone who is hanged on a tree falls under the curse of God. And when we read the New Testament, instead of cross, oftentimes, the writers will use the word tree. And they absolutely are thinking about this text. Because when you talk about the cross, they use the word tree. Now I want you to go with me to Galatians chapter 3. And I want you to notice the way Paul uses Deuteronomy 21. This is Galatians chapter 3 and verse 13. Christ redeemed us, notice this, from the curse of the law. How, Paul? By having become a curse for us, because it stands written, then he cites Deuteronomy 21, curses everyone who hangs upon a tree. Now think about the change that happened in Paul's mind. As a very religious Jew, a Pharisee, he believed that Jesus was an apostate. And he believed that Jesus was a blasphemer who deserved physical death. That's what he believed. And when he died by way of crucifixion, he believed he fell underneath God's curse because of his own sin. That's what he thought. And then these Jews who embraced Yeshua, he was outraged by them. And he sought them out in order for them to recant, and if they refused to recant, he was given the ability to kill them. And we're talking men and women. As he describes it in the book of Acts, as we read it, we read of Luke's telling of his conversion in chapter 9. But Paul gives his own conversion account in chapters 22 and 26 of the book of Acts. So he felt like, there's no question about it, as a very religious Jew, that he fell under the curse of Deuteronomy 21, and all Jews who embraced him should be persecuted, excommunicated, killed. That's what he believed. And then he was confronted by Jesus himself, and he was miraculously saved. And there was a major change that took place in his mind. And you know what he came to an understanding of? Jesus did fall under the curse. But it wasn't because of Jesus' sin. It was because of our sin. He paid the penalty of our sin. And that removed us from the curse. There was this major change that happened in his thinking. And the writer of Hebrews believed exactly the same thing. And he's pleading with these readers, leave behind Judaism and all the trappings of Judaism and go to the fulfillment. Why would you go back to the shadows when you have the substance? You have Jesus himself. He's the fulfillment of all this. And everything that is here and all the trappings of Judaism, temporary. What we have is permanent, is found in him. And so he pleads with them to leave this camp And now understanding that all of us are priests, offer these sacrifices to God through Jesus Christ. And he lists those three sacrifices. Praise, doing good, and sharing with others who have a need. We're all believer priests. We have sacrifices that we can offer. And we're to offer those sacrifices constantly. Now, this is Hebrews chapter 13 that takes us up to verse 16. I'm going to turn our attention to the 17th verse, Lord willing, next week. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for Thy precious Word. We thank Thee for the book of Hebrews that tells us about all of this preliminary stuff in the Old Testament that laid the foundation and placed this expectation of the future Messiah who would fulfill all of these things that we read about in the Old Testament. We thank Thee for the book of Hebrews and what we can gather and learn from this book, and pray that we would apply this to our own thinking, that all of us are priests and we're to offer these spiritual sacrifices unto Thee, and we know we can do it through Jesus Christ. So work in our hearts, we pray. And we ask that these sacrifices that we read about here would characterize all of us. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.